All right, we're underway with the recorder. And let's pick up a little bit of a review where we were last week. We will pick up the study on page 554 of your outline. We'll be looking at chapter 40, verse 1. Now, we did some introductory material last week as we approached chapter 40. Remember, chapter 39, verse 25, to the end of the book, we are now exclusively in the kingdom period. We're in the millennial kingdom. We also saw last week in our overview that these nine chapters drive the rabbis bonkers because there are contradictions with the Torah, with the Mosaic law, that they tried to harmonize in order to accept the book. They couldn't refuse the book because there were at least 15 short-term prophecies that verified Ezekiel as a true prophet of the Lord. So they couldn't reject the book, so they had to harmonize it to fit their theology. But we read from the Sanchino books of the Bible in regard to the rabbi Hananya, who tried to reconcile everything in Ezekiel 40 through 48 with the rabbinic theology, said, "Despite this rabbi's efforts at harmonization, many divergences were detected between the book and the Mosaic Code, which baffled all attempts at reconciliation." The problem, of course, is that the rabbis state that the Mosaic Code is eternal, and the Millennial Law Code is different in many significant areas, and they can't reconcile that. No problem for us, because we don't believe that the Mosaic Law was eternal in nature. It was fulfilled in Yeshua. It has been brought to its completion. It is no longer the rule of life for believers today. So we can move into the Millennial Law system with no problem. Then we took a look at the temple. I wanted to set up in your minds exactly which temple we're talking about. We looked at the timeline here, and the first Jewish worship structure was the tabernacle, built in 1446 BC, went to 960 BC. Here's a picture or two of the tabernacle, Israel surrounding the tabernacle. Here is the holy place and the Holy of Holies with the Shekinah glory, pillar of fire floating above it. Here's another nice illustration I kind of like. To me, that'd be amazing to see something like that, wouldn't it? Come out of your tent here, you know, in the middle of the night and look at that. You'd be bowled over. Anyway, I thought this was a nice illustration, the pillar of fire. And of course, we have built models of the tabernacle. If you go to Israel and go down to Timnah in the Negev, you can visit this model of the tabernacle, full size. All right, the tabernacle gave way to the first temple of Solomon in 960 BC, lasted till 586. And this is the temple that we're talking about that the Babylonians destroyed. Ezekiel was in Babylon, in Tel Aviv, but he was predicting the destruction of Jerusalem and this temple. And here's Rittmeyer's cutaway of the temple, his rendition of it as well. After the first temple, we had a 70-year hiatus during the exile to Babylon, 586 to 516. And then the second temple was built by Zerubbabel, enlarged by Herod, and visited by Yeshua. It lasted from 516 BC to 70 AD. Here is a drawing of the way the Temple Mount probably looked in the first century when Yeshua visited it. It began with Solomon building a square Temple Mount on the top of Mount Moriah. So this is Solomon's Temple Mount. Then in the Greek period, the Hasmonean period, the Maccabean period, the Maccabeans added on an extension to the south. And then Herod really went to work, and he added a little bit to the south, but he added a tremendous amount to the north. The yellow here is the original square Solomonic mount, Temple Mount. And of course, the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. And during the Muslim period, the Temple Mount platform was left, but no temple. And so the Dome of the Rock was built over the location of the temple. This is the way it looked in the Muslim period. So here it is again, the first century in which Yeshua walked in the temple. Here's another view, another drawing of the way the temple may have looked, the Herodian temple. All right, after the Second Temple, we had a long period of time from 70 AD to the present when no temple is on the Temple Mount, just the Dome of the Rock. Here's a picture of the Dome of the Rock today and an aerial view of the Temple Mount today. So you can see how it looks today. This is Al-Aqsa Mosque to the south. And most of these walls are Arabic and Crusader walls, but the original mount is, of course, below them. And you can see there's a lot of rubbish and garbage piled up that has to be sifted through. We'll talk about that a little bit more. This is the Western Wall Plaza here. When you see the Western Wall, that's the plaza you're at. All righty. No temple today, but we're expecting a third temple, the Tribulation Temple, to be erected soon. It'll stand during the Tribulation. It'll be destroyed after the Tribulation, and a fourth and final temple, the Millennial Temple, will be built by Yeshua. This is the temple that stands during the thousand-year kingdom. This is the temple we're looking at when we get into Ezekiel chapter 40 through, I'll say the end of the book, 40 through 48. Okay, this is what we're talking about, a future millennial temple. Question, yes?
Well, how long is the Tribulation Temple going to actually be standing?
We don't know. It has to be up and functioning by the middle of the Tribulation at the latest, but it could be built before the Tribulation. You know, we may see it any day, really, but once the Dome of the Rock gets cleared off, you know, somehow. But it'll stand for... We don't know. It'll stand for a minimum of 3.5+ years because it'll stand a little bit into the tribulation period and be torn down. It'll be the temple that's desecrated. So a minimum of, let's say, 3.5 years. Maximum, more than that. Yes?
I have a strange question. Do you think the rock that's inside the Dome of the Rock was there during that first temple?
It's very likely. Rittmeyer has written a book called The Quest, and he's done his book best to analyze all this, and he really... presents a strong case, that being the location of the Holy of Holies. Yeah, but we can't confirm any of that because the Muslims won't allow any archaeology up there. In fact, they are covering up as much archaeology as possible because they are claiming that this has never been a Jewish site. So it's been a Muslim site. So. Yes. Yeah, the Jewish community and the Muslim community do feel that that's Mount Moriah where Abraham was about to sacrifice Isaac. Yes. Okay. All righty. Then I showed you some drawings of the temple. Let's see, is that what I'm doing? No, Fourth Millennial Temple. That's the a rendition of that temple by the English, the ESV, English Standard Version. There's so many English versions out today. Anyway, we'll be using that diagram. I gave you that diagram last week. And there'll be no physical temple in the eternal order, in the eternal state, because the Lord God and the Lamb are the temple in the eternal state. We will also get a look at Millennial Mount Zion as we go through these chapters. Here's a close-up of the top of Millennial Mount Zion. All these features will be developed as we get to them. Then I gave you various artist renditions of the temple. Even though we have a lot of detailed dimensions, it's still pretty hard from our perspective to put it all together. So the drawings vary. So don't hold all these drawings in the palm of your hand. Don't get dogmatic about them. Here's the Millennial Temple according to the Logos Bible software map set, a kind of a three-quarter view. Here's a three-quarter view of an artist's rendering of the Millennial Temple. The Art Scroll Tanakh series diagram, it's a little different. The Expositor's Bible commentary diagram. I gave you all these diagrams in the handout. But that's the one we'll be using. And through as we go through the chapter, Ezekiel will give us a temple tour. I can't do this for you today, but Ezekiel can. He will take us into the Eastern Gate. We'll take a look at that today. Then from the Eastern Gate, he will take us into the Outer Court where we'll look at the chambers around the Outer Court. Then he will take us over to the Northern Outer Gate. We'll examine that gate. Then he'll walk about 1.5 miles to the Southern Outer Gate point four here. We'll take a look at that gate. Then the angel who's leading him around will take him into the inner court. We'll take a look at the southern inner gate. We'll go through that gate. We'll take a look at the events while that's happening in the inner court. The priest's rooms, for example, the places for sacrifice and where the instruments will be. And then Ezekiel will move us up into the temple itself, and we'll get a detailed look at the temple itself, the outer hallway, the holy place, the Holy of Holies. From there, we'll go out the northern inner gate, and we'll go to the western end of the Temple Mount, and we'll take a look at these buildings, quick review of them. Then Ezekiel will come all the way around to the main gate, the eastern outer gate. He will tell us about the altar of sacrifice. He will see the Shekinah glory enter through that gate, and then he will exit the temple and tell us what's outside the temple. And that's when we'll get to these details here on Millennial Mount Zion, and we'll look at the how Millennial Mount Zion corresponds to the Holy Land. We'll close the book by looking at the boundaries of the land. I'll present to you a position that presents the Promised Land as looking like this, something like this. And then we'll finish up by looking at the tribal allotments. The tribes will receive a very orderly allotment in the kingdom. All right, that's where we went last week. And let's pick it up then on page 554. Before we do, I do have a handout for you. Since we are getting into the millennium, I ran off a very, very short article on the idea of the millennium, or the synonymous terms, the Messianic Kingdom or the Millennial Kingdom. There's various terms by which this thousand-year period is known, so I don't want you to be confused. When we use the term millennium, we're focusing on the time frame. A millennium, 1,000 years. When we use the term Messianic Kingdom, we're focusing on the Messiah, the King who will be reigning from Jerusalem for those 1,000 years. So those are why we have the those synonymous terms for the millennium or the Messianic Kingdom. I do want to read the last two paragraphs. You guys get enough here? Okay, everybody have one? I do want to read the last two paragraphs because those two short little paragraphs, and believe me, this is a very short article, but it'll give you a little bit of an overview. Let's read those last two paragraphs because they help explain some of the terms that are floating around. You see the second paragraph from the bottom. The millennium is viewed by interpreters. Okay, everybody there? The millennium is viewed by interpreters in several different ways, three to be exact. One position holds that the millennium only refers to Christ's spiritual rule from heaven today. This symbolic view is known as the amillennial interpretation. In Greek, you put that ah sound at the beginning of a word and you negate it. If you have the millennium exists. If it's amillennial, the millennium does not exist, okay? So basically this view states that the book of Revelation and subsequent and corresponding books are just a symbolic rendition of the fact that it's evil fighting against good. Good and evil in conflict. And Jesus will return when he feels good and ready. Okay, we don't really know when he'll return. We are just to soldier on fighting against evil and presenting the gospel. Okay, and when Jesus is ready, he'll come back. So none of that is literal. It's all symbolic. Okay, there's no real millennium. We're in the millennium right now. You know, basically, there is no millennium. Okay, we're waiting for Jesus to return. Okay, another position views Christ's spiritual rule as working through preaching and teaching to bring gradual world improvement leading to Christ's return. This is the post-millennial view. Now, this is pretty much a dead view today. It pretty much died with World War I and World War II. I'm sure there are people that hold the post-millennial view. But their view was the church will permeate the world more and more and more and more and more till the world is just a great place to be, and when it's a great place to be, Jesus will return. When it's the gospel has permeated the entire world. So the world's going to get better and better and better and better and better. So there's not very many adherents to this view today. All right, but there are a lot of people that go with the amillennial view today, and I think that's because they don't study the prophets or take the prophets literally, and they're just too confused, and so, well, we'll just make it and throw it into symbolism. Anyway, the position that you'll get in this class is the final paragraph. The position that holds to an actual thousand-year period in the future is known as the premillennial view. This interpretation does not diminish the power of Christ's present rule from heaven or limit that rule to the church only. That position sees the need for a thousand-year place in history for an earthly fulfillment of Israel's promises of land and blessing. It stresses that the 1,000 years of Revelation 20 are actual years and not symbolic. So it's a literal view. The Messianic kingdom is the fulfillment of the promises to Abraham in the Abrahamic covenant, the fulfillment of the Davidic promises, the Davidic covenant, the land covenant, the new covenant, all of this. So we teach a literal view, a premillennial view here. Yes?
Well, the other two views take the Jews out.
Essentially, yes, yes. The amillennial view is essentially a replacement view where Israel really doesn't matter. It's just another nation. You know, some amillennial, well, no. Well, the best replacement theologians do see a future for Israel in the kingdom, but they see a kingdom of some sort. Amillennial people don't see a kingdom at all. All righty. Okay, so that is a little overview of the millennium that we're going to be looking at here. So let's begin then on page 554, point B, the middle of the page, introduction. The revelation to the prophet, first four verses. So we begin with the date that he received his revelation, very specific date, not a symbolic date. A literal date in history, chapter 40, verse 1. On the 25th year of our exile, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th of the month, in the 14th year after the city was taken, on that same day. So this is a very literal day, you guys. Point A, it's the 25th year of our captivity. So it's 573, 572 BC, somewhere in there, at the beginning of the year. Now, the term here in Hebrew is Rosh Hashanah, and most people associate that term Rosh Hashanah with the civil new year in the fall today. That is basically a rabbinic tradition. In the biblical times, the term referred to the beginning of the religious year. So don't be confused. This is biblical times that we're in here with Ezekiel. So it's a reference to the month of Nisan in the spring. March or April in the spring. It's the 10th day of the month. That was the day when the Passover lamb was set aside for observation to see that it was unblemished. So it's right close to Passover. Ezekiel's getting ready to observe Passover, just like we are. And it's the 14th year after the city was smitten. So 13 years have now elapsed since the fall of Jerusalem. Page 555. Notice his insistence, that self-same day, that literal day. April 28th, 573 BC is a possibility. Now the rabbis teach, point E2 on page 555, that this was a year of Jubilee. Now I've already given you out a handout about the year of Jubilee and the sabbatical year. Does anyone need that? This handout is in your earlier material. Does anyone want another copy at this point? I did do a few copies. Okay. Let me pass this back to Corrine and Carol. Don, John, you guys want one? Okay. All righty. You want one too? Okay. Here you go, please. Anyone else want one? No, some over here. Just a short article on the sabbatical year and the Jubilee. Again, you should all have this material already, but I figured somebody would want to stick it into the notebook right here. Question, yes, here you go. Oh, anyone else? Going. Do I bid? Have any more bids? Okay. All right, you can stick this little article in here. And if you're wondering about the sabbatical year, you'll have the information right in front of you. All righty. Now, in this year of Jubilee, possibly, just prior to Passover, Ezekiel's given a revelation of new things to come, point three. And that's a quick outline of the chapter, the new temple, chapter 40 to 43, the new worship, 43 through 46, and the new division of the Holy Land. The new division is a reference to the land itself. It will be divided up differently in the kingdom than it was previously, chapter 47 and 48. All right, let's take a look at that revelation itself, chapter 40, second part of verse 1. On that selfsame day, the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me there. So point A, the hand of Jehovah was upon me. He's going to experience a vision. He's about to receive a very unique vision of things to come. He brought me there. That's a reference to the land of Israel, the temple, the city of Jerusalem. That the way he was brought there is described in verse 2, the prophetic transport. That'd be a nice name for an Israeli airline, right? Prophetic transport. Better than Al Al, huh? Okay. Verse 2. In the visions of God, he brought me into the land of Israel and set me on a very high mountain. And on it, to the south, there was a structure like a city. All right. Remember, this is not physical transport. This is a vision. It's a vision so he can see the future. Here's a map of the Middle East. And, of course, here we have Jerusalem. This is where he's going. Babylonia is this region in the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley. The city of Babylon is located approximately there. And Ezekiel is living somewhere in this area in Tel Aviv by the Chebar Canal, somewhere in this area. And yes, Tel Aviv, not modern Tel Aviv, but the same name. Same name. Modern Tel Aviv, of course, is on the coast here, but this is Babylonian Tel Aviv. And so he's transported by prophetic transport from Tel Aviv to this very high mountain. And we'll see that he's plopped down. The plane makes a three-point landing right in front of the temple there. Right in front of the temple. Good. And he's on time, too. And probably doesn't need a computer to bring him down either. Yes. In a vision, yes. Right, physically he's probably in his living room in Tel Aviv. Yeah, but spiritually his the immaterial part of him is viewing all this. Okay. Okay, he is set down, point B, on a very high mountain. Now this will be the millennial mountain of Jehovah's house. And you can see on points B, 1, and 2 that there are two mentions of Millennial Mount Zion outside of Ezekiel. Let's take a look at Isaiah 2:2 and Micah 4:1. They say the same thing. They were contemporaries. Now it will come about that in the last days, this is the millennial kingdom, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains and will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. Now, this idea that it's the chief of the mountains means it'll be the most important geographical feature on planet Earth. And the fact that it's raised above the hills means that it'll be the highest geographical feature on planet Earth. Now, guys, hold on to your seatbelts. We are not talking about Mount Everest here, okay? Mount Everest is 29,029 feet high. We're not talking about Millennial Mount Zion being up there and you all have to wear oxygen masks to get up there, okay? We're talking Hebrew here. This is Har Tabor, Mount Tabor, Har Tabor. This qualifies as a mountain in the Hebrew language. How high is Mount Tabor? 1,200 feet, okay? This qualifies as a mountain. So Millennial Mount Zion does not have to be 5 miles in the sky in order to be qualify. We know that during the tribulation period, there'll be massive geological, geographical shifting going on. We know in the book of Revelation, it talks about the broad plain of the earth. And so I have a feeling Mount Everest will be gone by the time the tribulation is finished. Now, I don't think Millennial Mount Zion will be limited to 1,200 feet, but it will be a reasonable height. Here's an illustration of all nations streaming into Millennial Mount Zion. There's Millennial Mount Zion off in the distance. So all the nations are streaming there because it's the most important city on the planet. It's the capital city, the place where the king is reigning. But it's also higher than the other hills. And notice here, we've got some hills in the background, and this is the highest one. So it's just going to be the tallest one. Whether it will be dramatically taller or not, we don't know. Exactly how it will look, we don't know. But it will be the most important and highest mountain on planet Earth. By the way, what time of the year are these folks going up to Millennial Mount Zion here? You can see it in the, what? Feast of Tabernacles, right. All nations will stream into Jerusalem to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Booths. And here you see the Jewish people making some tabernacles, some booths there. Okay, so don't think that we have to have a 5 mile high mountain or a 3 mile high mountain. All right, points 3 and 4, previous mention of the Millennial Mount Zion, Ezekiel chapter 17 and chapter 20. And he says, as he looks to the south, he's plopped down in the temple here, and he looks to the south and he sees the outline of a city, a cityscape to the south. And that will be a reference to Jerusalem. We will take a look at Millennial Jerusalem when we get there. So that's what he's seeing. All right, page 556. He gets escorted off his divine airliner, and he's met at the temple by an angel, the man with the measuring line. He gets a red carpet treatment here, you guys, verse 3. So he brought me there, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of bronze, with a line of flax and a measuring rod in his hand, and he was standing in the gateway. So he brought me there, the mountain, Millennial Mount Zion, and the temple. Behold, there was a man. Now, when angels appear, they usually appear in the form of a man. And they don't look like these cute little angels you see in drawings with the wings and all that. Seraphim have wings. Cherubim have wings, but run-of-the-mill angels look like men. This may be, point one here, the angel of the Lord. Some strong hints of that in verse 2 and verse 5 of chapter 44. Now, the angel of the Lord, without going into an explanation, is basically a pre-incarnate appearance of Yeshua, pre-incarnate appearance of the second person of the Trinity. So if this is the angel of the Lord, he's gotten red carpet treatment. Okay? Big time. So we have an angel, at least an angel in the form of a man, but not quite in the form of a man, because point C, the appearance of this angel is like copper or bronze. This man has a metallic sheen, a metallic look to him, like he's made out of metal, copper or bronze. And that metal has some very important symbolic uses in Scripture. You can see them there. Number one, it's often used as a symbol of strength. Let's take a look at Micah 4:13. Micah says, "Arise and thresh, daughter of Zion, for your horn I will make iron and your hooves I will make bronze, so that you may pulverize many peoples, that you may devote to the Lord their unjust gain and their wealth to the Lord of all the earth." So you see under the symbol of a horse there, we have hooves of bronze, strong hooves that will crush the peoples, Micah 4:13. Secondly, it's a symbol of steadfastness, unwavering steadfastness. It can be either in a good sense, which we would call steadfastness, or in an evil sense, which we would call stubbornness. And in the negative side, we have Isaiah 48:4. Bronze used in a negative sense, because I know that you are obstinate, and your neck is an iron sinew, and your forehead bronze. Speaking of the Jewish people here, this is not exactly the most wonderful thing to be told. So here, bronze is a picture of being obstinate, stubborn. But in a positive way, Jeremiah 1:18, now behold, I have made you today as a fortified city and as a pillar of iron and as walls of bronze against the whole land, to the kings of Judah and its princes, to its priests and the people of the land. Jeremiah, you're going to have to stand against all these people. And I have empowered you. You are like a wall of bronze. You will withstand their assaults. So that's a positive side of the symbol. Jeremiah will be steadfast. It's also used as a symbol of judgment here. Point three, we'll look at Leviticus 26:19. If Israel sins, God says, I will also break down your pride of power. I will make your sky like iron and your earth like bronze. In other words, I am going to afflict you with drought. And that land of yours is going to be so dried up, it's going to be like a sheet of metal at your feet. It's going to be so hard and dry and unproductive. So all of these, all of this suggests that this angelic being is very unique. Very unique. Now the angelic being, let's see, when do we get to the next verse? Boy, I'm already into your break, you guys. Why don't we stop right there before you get too mad at me? And we'll pick it up at point D at the bottom of page 556. We'll look at the measurements in the hand of this angel. All right, we're back underway again. All right, let's pick it up again at the bottom of page 556. We've been introduced to this angelic being that has this metallic appearance. And he has something in his hand. Point D at the bottom of the page, he has two kinds of measuring devices in his hand. Point D1 at the bottom of the page is a line of flax, and that's used for the longer measurements. It's also called the rod, and it's approximately 10 feet. Now, the dimensions, the distances that we state here will all be approximate because the measuring system in Ezekiel's day and our measuring system are not the same. They're quite a bit different, so they don't coordinate perfectly. So we'll give you approximate distances. Well, it probably is literally that, a line with knots at either end or, you know, that would mark out a specific distance. Yeah. All right, page 557. He also has number two at the top of the page, the measuring reed. And this was for the shorter distances. And it's also called a cubit. Also called a cubit. And notice there are two types of cubits. The short cubit, approximately 18 inches, which would be your forearm from your elbow to your end of your fingers, depending on who you are. You know, my cubit's going to be a little shorter than Kevin's cubit. You know? about 18 inches, about five hand breadths. And then the long cubit, which is approximately 21 inches, six hand breadths. And it's the long cubit that is the temple cubit here. We learn in verse 5 and in verse 13 of chapter 43 that it's the six hand breadth cubit. So we will be using the long cubit measurement throughout. Point E on page 557, he stood at the gate. This will be the east gate to the temple. We'll see that when we get to verse 6. And the beginning of the temple tour will be at that gate, and temple tour will end at that gate, verse 3. And then in point F, there are other references to the man with the measuring line in Zechariah and Revelation. So this is not something unique or particularly new. All right, page 558. This man gives instruction to Ezekiel in verse 4. Chapter 40, verse 4, page 558. The man said to me, "Son of man, see with your eyes, hear with your ears, give attention to all that I'm going to show you, for you have been brought here in order to show it to you. Declare to the house of Israel all that you see." Point B, basically, pay close attention. Give me very, very, very intense attention, Ezekiel. Point one, with your eyes, give careful visual observation to all you see. Note carefully. With your ears, be attentive verbally. Be attentive to all that I say to you. Three, set your heart on this. Give it the closest scrutiny. The point is that the details that he's about to lay out before Ezekiel are to be noted. And folks, they're there for us as well. They're not there to bore us to death. They're there to teach us. So we need to pay attention to these as well. If anyone falls asleep in this class, in this section of Ezekiel, I hear that their lightning bolts will come out of the light fixtures, okay? All right, now the night class is going to have the most difficulty with this. You guys are going, you know. Yeah, they're doing better. They've had a long day. All right, so the purpose, point C. The purpose for this close attention is so that he can declare all of this to the house of Israel. He's responsible to remember this and to share the details. So it's a very important revelation that is not to be ignored by Israel, nor should it be ignored by the church. We should not minimize this. If God thinks it's important, we should think it's important. We may not understand it, but we need to say, "Okay, Lord, I am going to pour my heart into this because I understand that you take you put great stock in this." All right, we begin with the millennial temple in chapter 40, verse 5. We begin by looking at the outer wall in verse 5. "And behold, there was a wall on the outside of the temple all around. And in the man's hand was a measuring rod of 6 cubits, each of which was a cubit and a handbreadth." So you see it's a temple measurement. "So he measured the thickness of the wall, one rod, and the height, one rod." So here we begin our temple tour. Ezekiel is standing outside of the eastern gate. This is the main gate to the temple. So he's in this position. You have this diagram. I gave it to you in a handout. All right, this wall that he sees is 10 feet thick. And then page 559 at the top of the page, point four, a little over 10 feet high. Now there you see 10.5 feet high. That should say 10 1/3, I believe. Everything else says 10 1/3, so I believe that's a typo. So 10 1/3 feet wide, 10 1/3 feet high. Not very high, just as high as a basketball hoop. So it isn't going to serve as a defensive bulwark against an enemy attack. It just, even in those days, it would be ineffective. And in the kingdom, the temple is not going to need protection from a hostile army. It's not going to worry about being put under siege. So the purpose for this wall is that of separation. We'll learn that when we get to chapter 42, verse 20, because a similar wall is mentioned in chapter 42, verse 20. He said he measured it on the four sides, and it had a wall all around, the length 500 and the width 500, to divide between the holy and the profane. So So this other wall that we'll run into in chapter 42 divides between the, provides separation between that which is holy and that which is secular. And that's probably the reason for the wall here. When people come up to the temple, they're being told, okay, you are approaching holy ground here. So let's take this seriously. All right. Now, he gives us a look at the eastern gate, starting in the first part of verse 6. Point B, parentheses 1, the gate, first part of verse 6. Then he went to the gate which faced east. He went up its steps. So we go back to our temple here. And here is the gate that he's talking about. It's the gate that looks east. It's the outer eastern gate. Now, if you turn to page 566 of your outline, you will find a diagram of this gate. I will put up a diagram or two on the screen, but you will have a simplified diagram on page 566. So if you want to refer to that, put a sticky pad there or something, post-it note there, and you can turn to it. So this gate is the main approach to the temple, and there are steps leading up. And we see in our diagram here there are steps going up. So the Millennial Mount Zion on the outside of the temple is a lower level, and you have to go up to get to the outer court from ground level. Now he begins to describe the thresholds. And now this is a different diagram. This diagram comes out of the Expositor's Bible Commentary. It's a little different than the diagram you have in your notes, but it covers the same material. It's a little bit confusing with all the measurements there, but I chose to use it because I could scan it in and I'll isolate the features that we're talking about as best I can. I can't isolate all the features because they don't always show up on all the diagrams. It's a little hard to determine exactly what they're like, but I'll isolate them on this diagram for you. All right, first part of verse 6. Then he went up the gate which faced east, and he went up its steps. Now in point B, I should say verse 6, B, he begins to measure this gateway. And he measured the threshold of the gate, one rod in width, and the other threshold was one rod in width. So the threshold he's talking about is this OT, the outer threshold of the gate. That's the area he's talking about. It's the threshold that faces the outside, faces to the east. Then the other threshold. So apparently what the angel does is then walk down the corridor to the inner threshold down here. And he measures it. And this is the threshold facing the inner court. And again, it's 10 feet. In verse 7, the angel now measures the alcoves or the lodges or the guard chambers. Verse 7. The guard room was one rod long and one rod wide, and there were 5 cubits between the guard rooms. And the threshold of the gate by the porch of the gate facing inward was one rod. Now what he's talking about here are these guard rooms, A in this diagram, alcoves, whatever you want to call them. But they're square little rooms, 10 feet by 10 feet. Apparently, accommodations for the ministering priests who would somehow serve in these little rooms. Now he says there's spaces between the guard rooms of 5 cubits, and that would be these spaces here. They're separated by walls 5 cubits wide. So there are going to be 6 cells in the corridor in this passageway, 3 on the north side and 3 on the south side. Point B3 there. Again, 5 cubits square. Each guard room, 5 cubits square. Then he talks about point C in the bottom of page 560, the threshold of the gate by the porch of the gate toward the house. And apparently he is talking about this area here. The threshold of the gate. Apparently it's this area here. All right, let's move on to page 561. In verse 8, he measures this porch, and that's why the P is there in this diagram for the porch. Verse 8. Then he measured the porch of the gate facing inward one rod. So it's 10 feet, and exactly where that dimension is on this diagram, I'm not sure. One rod. It may be the thickness of the wall of the porch. Apparently, it is not in this diagram. Then, verse 9, he does another measurement. He measured the porch of the gate 8 cubits and its side pillars 2 cubits, and the porch of the gate was faced inward. So we have an 8-cubit measure, apparently the width there. 14 feet or so, 0.5A2, 14 feet. So apparently this is from east to west, the width of the porch right here. 8 cubits, east to west, 14 feet. Then there's some kind of door jams there, point B. They're 2 cubits in size. And then he states point C at the bottom of the page. This was the porch toward the house. And point C2, this porch would be facing toward the temple. It would be facing west then. East would be the outside of the complex. This would be the inside of the complex. So point 2, one porch facing toward the temple. Point 3, one porch facing away from the temple. Then he turns our... Question.
On verse 6, it said, if you went into the gate and looked east, it's looking east, why wouldn't that be the west gate? I mean, he's looking toward the east.
Well, he's talking about, there is no western gate in the temple compound. You'll see when we get to it that the western side has no gate at all.
I'm still confused. If he's at the east gate, he's looking into the temple, he's looking eastward.
He's looking westward. He's standing here, he's looking westward. Well, I can't. I don't know why you are. Let's see, verse 6. Then he went into the gate which faced east. According to the NASB, translates it faced east, and went up its steps. Yeah, the man. That's right. Mac makes the good point. The man is facing west. The gate is facing east. This is the outside of the gate. It's facing east. The man is facing west. Yeah. Okay? Yeah. Okay? Yeah, I understand. That's why I'm trying to do this visually. And to refer to your diagram on page 566. You can kind of bend your notes back a little bit if you want to. And you'll see this diagram is similar to the one I have up here. The basic elements are still there. All right. Verse 10, we look at the guard rooms again. The guard rooms of the gate toward the east numbered 3 on each side. The 3 of them had the same measurements. The side pillars also had the same measurement on each side. So again, he's talking about these guard rooms. We already looked at them, A in this diagram. These are the alcoves, or guard rooms. And there's 6 of them, 3 to the north, 3 to the south, all about 10 feet square. And then they have door jams of some sort that are 3.5 feet thick. Verse 11, he measured the width of the gateway, 10 cubits, and the length of the gate, 13 cubits. Apparently, this is the outer threshold again, and it's 17.5 feet wide, and then 6 cubits deep, 10 cubits wide. And the length of the gate, he says 22 3/4 feet at the bottom of the page. Apparently, this is the corridor running down the length of the gateway, this corridor running down here between the side rooms. Apparently, and I use the word apparently because nobody is really quite sure about all these diagrams, about all these measurements. We're doing our best from our location thousands of years down the road. Page 563. He talks about a border before the alcoves or before the lodges. This border is noted with dotted lines on page 566 in front of each alcove. All right, let's read verse 12. There was a barrier wall 1 cubit wide in front of the guard rooms on each side, and the guard rooms were 6 cubits square on each side. So up in our diagram, apparently there's some little barrier walls here right in front of each guard room. So these are 10 feet. They're apparently just a few inches, 21 inches high, 1 3/4 feet high, but they're 10 feet in length, covering the front of each alcove or guard room. So just a small little barrier, not something that would prevent entry into the guard room, but something that just is kind of protecting the guard room from just casual entrance. You would see over the top of it. Now, there will be doors to enter these rooms from the other side. We'll see. Verse 13. Now, he measured the gate from the roof of one guard room to the roof of the other, a width of 25 cubits from one door to the door opposite. Now, this is apparently the entire width of the gate from side to side. See our 25 cubits here? Apparently the entire width of this gate from roof to roof on the outside. So this thing is 25 cubits wide, which would be a total of 44 feet. .91. Total width about 43 3/4 feet, 44 feet. Then notice point 9b at the bottom of your page. It speaks of door against door. So it suggests that there's a door from the side rooms to the outer court. So apparently there's a door into these alcoves on the outside of each one out here into the outer court. So the entrance into the alcove apparently is from the outside, and then there's this little barrier wall that's only a foot and a half or so high. But the people in the alcove, the priests in the alcove, probably do not exit over that wall. They probably do some kind of service over that wall, something. We'll have to wait, I think, to the kingdom to see the details. Okay? All right, shall I move on? Okay, let's turn to page 564, verse 14. And he made the side pillars 60 cubits wide, high, excuse me, and the gate extended round about to the side pillar of the courtyard. So now there's some kind of posts or pillars or architectural feature now that's 105 feet tall. That's pretty tall, isn't it? 100 feet tall at the front of the gate. Some kind of pillar. Maybe it's the height of the gate itself in totality, but probably not. Some kind of decorative pillar of some sort, or columns at the front of the gate. Now, the length of the gate, we've learned the gate is 25 cubits wide. And now we learn the length of the gate overall in verse 15. From the front of the entrance gate to the front of the inner porch, the gate was 50 cubits. So here in our diagram, we have this 50-cubit total length of the gate from east to west. 25 cubits wide, 50 cubits in length. So about 87, 88 feet in length. entire length of the gateway, point B. He turns his attention now to the windows in the guard rooms in verse 16. There were shuttered windows looking toward the guard rooms and toward their side pillars within the gate all around, and likewise for the porches. And there were windows all around inside, and on each side pillar, palm tree ornaments. Now some, so as far as the what we're looking at now are these windows. On this diagram, they are identified with the zeros, these O's here. Apparently, he's talking about these windows now. Some translations say they were closed windows. There's various ways you can render the Hebrew here. Some render it shut windows or shuttered windows, NESB. Maybe these are shutters of lattice work of some sort. No glass in the windows, apparently. Others translate this as narrowed windows. In other words, the windows were started wide and narrowed down to a narrow dimension at the end. And that's what Dr. Fruchtenbaum has on his diagram on page 566. You see those little triangles? He has interpreted this as narrowed windows. So that's why they're drawn at that angle there. Start wide and they narrow down. Again, we'll just have to see when we get there, you guys. Question?
Does that mean we have both doors and windows?
Yes, there are doors and windows on the outside here. The windows may be above the doors. We don't know. We'll see. We don't know the actual height of this thing unless it's that 105-foot dimension. You know, the pillars may just be 105 feet, but he doesn't give us a vertical height for a clear vertical height for the whole gate. Unless it's that 105-foot dimension. Okay. All right, so we have windows providing light for the alcoves, for the guard rooms. Windows of some sort. Now, it's interesting, on page 565, he talks about the decorations in the temple. God is not against decoration and beauty. The tabernacle was heavily decorated and very beautiful, with cloth and gold and other items. Solomonic temple. Point one, had palm trees decorating it. And you see points A, B, and C on page 565 are references to the decorations of the Solomonic temple. And again, there's symbolic association with palm trees. Point two, it's a symbol of feminine beauty. Song of Solomon, chapter 7, verse 7. This is an illustration of this. Solomon says to his wife, Shulamit, your stature is like a palm tree. So he's admiring. She's tall and she's slim. And so that's his, I don't know if I should tell my, any, you know, should you tell your wife you're like a palm tree? I don't know how that would go over with today, guys. So, okay. So go home, ladies, to your husband and say, do I resemble a tree to you? You know. Well, King Solomon. All right, so in King Solomon's culture, a symbol of beauty here. His wife was tall and slim. Also, point three, it's a symbol of the blessings of righteousness. And I want to cover both the Old Testament and the New Testament reference there, Psalm 92, verses 12 and 13. The righteous man will flourish like what? Like the palm tree. He will grow like a cedar. There's another tree symbol. Like a cedar of Lebanon, planted in the house of our God. They will flourish in the courts of our God. So here we have the palm tree associated with righteousness along with the cedar tree. And then we come into the book of Revelation, and that same picture is picked up because the book of Revelation isn't really all that new. It's based on the prophets. After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one could count, from every nation and all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, and palm branches were in their hands. So these are the righteous believers here, and they're identified with these palm branches. It's also a symbol of the Feast of Tabernacles. Point four there, Leviticus 23:40. Now on the first day, and this is the Feast of Tabernacles, you shall take for yourselves the foliage of beautiful trees, and one of those beautiful trees are palm branches. also the boughs of leafy trees and willows of the brook, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days. So these tree branches were brought up to the Feast of Tabernacles to celebrate the feast. And we know that the Feast of Tabernacles will be fulfilled in the kingdom, point D, point 4D, Zechariah 14, 16 through 19. And so this is a very appropriate decoration to have in the millennial kingdom. Then it will come about that any who are left of all the nations that went against Jerusalem will go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and celebrate the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Tabernacles. So in the kingdom, it'll be mandatory for all the nations to at least send representatives to Jerusalem to celebrate Tabernacles. And so this feast that is so associated with palms, with palm trees, will be fulfilled in the kingdom. Point 13, the bottom of page 565. These gates of the Millennial Temple are patterned after the Solomonic city wall gates. These Solomonic city wall gates were discovered by archaeologists, and there's a beautiful example of them at Megiddo. Here's a picture of Megiddo. Here's into the main entrance of Megiddo. Here's the corridor leading into the city, and you see these massive thick walls on either side of the corridor. And implanted in these walls are the guard rooms. Now, of course, these rooms would be used by soldiers who would station themselves in those rooms and attack any enemy breaching the gate. But the design is the same. Massive walls with the guard rooms. Can you see that clearly there? That picture clear enough? And there's one of our students going into Megiddo at the end there. So that's the basic design. So now on page 566, you come to that diagram of the Eastern Gate and the basic measurements and verses are listed there for you. So I think it's a pretty clear little diagram for you to use and take home. Okay, does that make sense? That make clear sense? All righty. Now, as we get to verse 17, we now go inside the outer court. And we'll just have enough time to go into the outer court itself in verse 17. Then he brought me into the outer court, and behold, there were chambers and a pavement made for the court all around. 30 chambers faced the pavement. So let's go back to our diagram of the Millennial Temple. Ezekiel is here. He has just been taken by the angel into the gate, into the Eastern Gate. He's given us the details of the guard rooms. And now he takes us outside the gate, through the gate. And in your diagram, we're going to look at the outer court, which is G on the diagram that you have that I handed out to you. So next week, we'll take a look at these chambers, and we'll take a look at the pavement. We'll take a look at many of the details in the outer gate. We'll move through that fairly quickly as well. All righty, let me go ahead and close in prayer, and I'm going to turn you guys loose, and we'll pick it up next week with our temple tour continues. Oops, excuse me, thanks. Kevin reminded me. 2 weeks, right? 2 weeks. Passover is next week. So in 2 weeks, we'll pick up our temple tour again. Father, again, I want to thank you for your word. Help us, Lord, to remember that you have emphasized to us, to Ezekiel, and to us, that this is a very, very important part of your revelation. It deals with the millennial worship structure, a structure that is going to teach us great lessons about the Messiah and about you. And right now, Lord, I confess it's a little hard to understand exactly how all this looks and how all the dimensions work out. But one thing we do know, Lord, this is a literal building, just like Solomon's temple and Zerubbabel's temple and the tabernacle. And we are going to experience this building in the kingdom. So help us to anticipate that as we work our way diligently and carefully through all these dimensions and do our best to understand it, so that when we come to the temple in the kingdom, it'll feel like coming home. And we'll say, oh, yeah, I always wondered what that 105-foot thing was. It'll be like coming home. So Lord, give us a hope and a look into the future as we go through this material. We ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen.